Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal. I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every Monday to Friday from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
Doing great, man.
You know, I'll do a little, you know, over self-disclosing blogging out there. I mean, I just
You talk about over self-disclosing. People walk up to me like, "Hey, I've never met me before." They're like, "Hey, Mark, how are you? How's Jennifer? How's the four kids? How's everything?" I'm like, "Oh, I guess I've been overdoing it again on the radio."
Well, you're right, and I get the same thing. But my girlfriend's just moved in. We just moved in together.
Mm-hmm. You are over disclosing. There you go.
No. Well, here, but there's the food aspect to this. And the food aspect is, first of all, I have food in my house for the first time in a long time. We're on Fresh Direct. I get Fresh Direct a lot, and it's good. But also, as I've been a bachelor for a long time, and I eat mostly in the restaurant, mm-hmm. and Jennifer has been discovering things in my closet.
you know, there are so many jokes there, I won't even go.
In my food pantry. Can we say in my food pantry? So Jennifer's found stuff like...
Better than the things that Jennifer's digging out of your closet.
She's like, Francis, do you realize that this irradiated milk, although it was irradiated, it expired in 1989? Not really. The oldest thing we found was from 1997.
And Francis, what's this skeleton over here? Tell me about
it's
this.
It's not working. It's not flying. We've been going through some of the things in my closet. Like the oatmeal was from 1997. That expired in 97.
Wow.
What goes wrong with oatmeal?
I don't know.
It was Quaker Oats. It was the instant stuff.
Gross mold, probably.
We threw it out anyway.
Good for you.
But the Irish oatmeal, never goes bad. The stuff that's like totally dry in a metal can, you can keep that forever.
I don't believe you're
telling
the truth.
Yeah, no, it's true. We made some. So,
oh, man. So, well, that explains the expression on your face this morning when you got here.
Well, no, so we found a bunch of old food in there, and we also recently melded our libraries, which is cool because we come from different political points of view. So, like, mm-hmm. Ann Coulter sits on the shelf next to Al Franken.
You know,
they're staring at each other.
You talk about those old food stories.
Uh-huh.
And I have an aunt whom I love very, very much, but is a little bit of a, you know, she's one of those people who collects a lot of things.
Pack rat.
And I will never, ever in my whole life forget the story of my aunt calls me up one day and says, "Hi, I got a can of snails here. For how long do you think a can of snails is good?" And I thought, I don't know. Maybe a can of snails is good for 2 years, 3 years. I don't know. What's the can say? "Well, it doesn't read anything here on the can. I can't tell." I said, "Well, you know, how old are the snails?" 25 years. And my uncle is chirping in the background, 30! 30! The snails are at least 30 years old!
I would wear a pair of safety goggles when I opened those.
Aunt Marianne? Yeah. Throw the snails away. Don't eat the snails.
Oh.
Bad things will happen to you. But literally every time I go to her house and she's got, you know, these gigantic Sub-Zero refrigerator and a gigantic Sub-Zero freezer, and of course she has a refrigerator in the garage because she's Italian.
Right.
So you got to have the backup refrigerator just in case.
Right. Somebody brings over a deer. Right. I got it. We have the same thing. I'm Irish. We have the same thing.
But literally,
except my father would occasionally come home with a deer.
I will go through before I let her feed anything to my children. I'm like, orange marmalade, 94. You can't feed that to my kids. Strawberry jam, 97. Feed that to my kids. So I empathize with you.
Thank you. But we're going through the same thing, absolutely. But I have to say, we had another modern. I don't have cable. I don't have a microwave. I'm a bit of a throwback at home in a number of
You're
ways.
You're crazy.
A little crazy. Okay. I'm a little crazy.
Because I can't go to bed without watching ESPN.
Sorry, don't have it. Well, we'd moved all of her food into our pantry,
mm-hmm.
and actually, we rented a movie. And we're going to watch the movie. We're going to have popcorn. She's like, oh, I totally feel like buttered popcorn. I know it's all artificial and stuff, but I, you know, I love that butter flavor popcorn. And she went and she said, I'll pop some popcorn. And she grabbed the microwavable popcorn bag. And there's no microwave.
She said, no worrying about the bisphenol A there. Cause,
she was so crestfallen. And she said, do you think we can put it in the oven? I said, I don't know, but it could burst into flames and pop all over the place at the same time. It could be a real disaster. So
what you probably could do, Francis,
cut it open and
put it open and make popcorn.
But
put it in a pan with a little bit of oil.
But no, I remembered that in the cabinets that I had seen as we tried to pack it all in together, like her stuff and my stuff, there was an old Jiffy Pop popcorn, like, you know, the metal tin.
It
thing.
Was yours or hers?
Mine.
Okay.
I'm sure.
Did you have a niece or nephew coming over?
No, I'm sure that I moved it from New Brunswick to Jersey City 7 years ago when I moved to Jersey City, and I'm sure it had been in the cabinet in New Brunswick for a while.
Uh-huh.
In case you're wondering, popcorn doesn't go bad for at least a decade.
All right.
So, Jennifer.
There you go. There's one of those things that you can put in your survival unit. Yeah. You can put popcorn and Twinkies.
Jennifer, but there's nothing artificial in the Jiffy Pop. It's just popcorn and oil.
Mm-hmm.
So, Jennifer is a little younger than I am and had never popped popcorn anyway but in the microwave. So she's like, is that going to work? I don't know, to be honest.
She had never popped Jiffy Pop?
No. Nope.
Okay, I got to tell you, that is like one of the rites of passage that every child in the world.
Do you do it at home with your kids?
We have, of course, that every child in the world should pop Jiffy Pop. Because that is the, seeing that little tinfoil thing expand into a big chef's hat looking thing until it almost bursts open.
Haven't done it in a decade.
It's the coolest thing ever.
We popped the Jiffy Pop, and she said, you know, I know it's kind of trashy, but I love that artificially flavored butter flavor. It's unfortunate we don't have that. I was like,
I know what I have. I have something that said, might be reminiscent of that flavor.
I said, sweetie, we have butter. She said, is that going to taste like the movies though? I said, I think so. I think it'd be better. And she looked at me with, like, you know, one eye open. Like, and so I melted butter and I just browned it just a little bit.
Uh-huh.
And we poured it on top of the freshly popped Jiffy Pop.
Yeah,
it was great. And boy, when I put butter on there, it's great when it's hot, but as it starts to cool, it starts to solidify around the popcorn. Absolutely perfect. Jiffy Pop and butter.
Can I tell you? And phase two of that little experiment.
Yeah.
Okay. Toss a little truffle oil into that.
Yeah, we weren't going
for
the high end.
Parmesan cheese. Oh my goodness gracious.
We weren't going for the high end that night.
There are some things that you can really do at home to just enhance that little popcorn experience.
Garlic powder.
And garlic powder. See, we don't do garlic powder in my family. We do garlic.
You could saute a little garlic in the butter.
Saute a little garlic and make yourself like a garlic bread popcorn.
Yeah.
I mean, popcorn is one of those great vehicles. Don't be afraid to experiment a little bit. Throw some herbs on there. Put some grated cheese on there. You eat the smart pop with the cheese on it, with the cheddar cheese powdery stuff on it. Go ahead and put some grated cheese on there. Melt some
Mark,
actual butter on your
Mark,
popcorn. Yeah,
you're making nachos with the popcorn.
Whatever. Popcorn does. You can do anything with popcorn. It is one of the great vehicles of mankind.
And sometimes you just want popcorn, salt, and butter. Oh, and we had the really good sea salt. Sea salt on popcorn is great because the thing about sea salt is it's not as salty as regular salt, and it's textural, so it crunches. And so you get the crunch of the popcorn, the crunch of the salt, and the butter on top.
Yeah, but I'd be afraid I was eating one of those really hard kernels that's going to make my teeth hurt.
Don't be afraid, little Marky. It'll be okay. We'll be back in just a moment. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi, restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. And today we're talking with our friend winemaker Tim Olson, who's on the phone with us from California, to talk about some of his new wines and what's going on in the California wine scene from really small, high-quality producers like Tim. Tim is only actually 3'2". No, I don't mean small producers like that. I mean he doesn't make a lot of wine, but his wines are remarkable. Hey,
Tim Olson, welcome to the show.
How you doing, guys?
We're doing great, man. How have you been?
Things have been good. We're battling a little inclement weather out here right now. It's been raining off and on, but you know what they say. April showers bring May grapes.
Now, what's going on since we've last spoken to you? We should fill people in on our background a little bit. We became friends back in the late 90s or the mid to late 90s when you were with a company called Tarius. You made Tarius wines, and I think the 99 vintage of Tarius wines, both Zinfandel And Pinot Noir were just, they were revelations. I had a bottle of Tarius Pinot Noir, maybe my last one just recently. It was phenomenal. And since then, you've gone on and you have a label under your own name with your partner, John Ogden. It's Olson Ogden Wines. So started in what year?
We started in 2002.
And you guys are a really small production, what we call in the business garagistes, you know, people who are, you know, very small production, not big industrial wine producers. Isn't that right?
Well, that's true. And, you know, the garagiste thing is sometimes misapplied to people that actually have small facilities. But this being 2007, this is actually my 20th anniversary of making wine, which actually started in the garage in my home in Pleasant Hill. And I started off thinking I would make just a little bit of homemade wine because, as I say to people, I am my own customer. I started off as a wine lover and actually still am. But I decided, hey, it'd be fun to make a little homemade wine and see what that's all about. And I got very lucky. I met a man named George Hendry who makes incredible wines, has a great vineyard up in Napa. And he sold me a little bit of grapes to make some homemade wine with. And, well, he was kind enough to give me some advice and get me going. And the second year, he gave me some grapes again. And I also hooked up with Charlie Wagner from Camus. And there must have been a little serendipity involved because it just got me very excited about the whole process, and it literally changed my career.
Well, let's be honest, too. George didn't give you grapes. He sold you grapes.
At a really good price.
Now, I think that what's interesting about your story, Tim, is a lot of people are home winemakers or they'll do something out of love and just do it on an amateur level. But how did you go from making wine basically as an amateur, as a home winemaker, to actually making a living out of it? I mean, did you have a background in chemistry?
I think there are a lot of people who dream about, you know, going through your path, and I just like to give people some insight as to how they could possibly do that.
Well, you know, interestingly enough, I'm actually in the process of writing a book about this very thing. I've been talking to a lot of people as we've been starting to do more and more marketing and get our name and our brand out there, and people say, hey, how did you get to where you are? And it literally started in the garage and just progressed up. So, it's hard to describe why something becomes a passion, but it did. Probably the hardest thing for me was getting into the business because of the old adage, you can't get a job without any experience, and you can't get any experience without a job.
Right.
And I'd never worked in the wine business. You know, I have a degree in marketing. I was a film major in college. And so I literally volunteered. I went up there, and I'd been working with Charlie Wagner at Camus for a few years. And I said, hey, I need to get some experience. I'll work for free. And they said, okay.
I was going to say, any of you folks out in listener land who want to get a little experience in the restaurant business and work for free, call me up. We can take a similar path. I'm sorry I interrupted you. Go on.
No, it's true. It's you know what? That's the best way to get some experience. And what happened was a couple weeks into it, they came into me and said, you're actually working hard. And I said, well, yeah, I love this. And they said, well, if you're going to work this hard, we'll actually pay you then.
You know,
so it actually turned out okay.
And my advice to a lot of people, especially in the restaurant business, but you're talking about the wine business, those kinds of things, they happen very similarly. If you're really into the wine business or the restaurant business, don't quit your job, but go and work for somebody for free for a little while. And A, you'll find out whether you really want to do it and quit your job and make it your profession. But B, you really show people how dedicated and how much you want to be involved in the process, and you'll be surprised at how quickly somebody doesn't want to lose you puts you on the payroll.
You couldn't have said it better, Mark. In fact, I was just watching the Food Network last night, and they were talking about a couple of chefs who are in the pastry business, and they were in a competition and started talking about what they used to do, and they were in the semiconductor business, husband and wife, and started playing around with food at home with friends, and same idea, just fell for it. Went in and did some work for free, got into it and became professionals, went to the Culinary Academy, and boom, there you go. So I would advise anybody to follow your heart, follow your passion, and if winemaking is something that appeals to you, I might have been lucky in that I lived 45 minutes away from Napa Valley, but you know what? There's wine being made in 47 states. You can make wine anywhere.
Yeah, but the really good wine isn't being made in 47 states.
Alaskan wine stinks.
Yeah, New Jersey wine, generally overall, with some exceptions, is not super great. Obviously, it's better to be that in California, but what I think is very interesting about your change in career is we encounter a lot of people, and a lot more people since we've had this radio show, who call us up and say, yeah, I want to get involved in the wine side of the restaurant business. And you know, I say, you know, there is no way to get involved in the wine side of the restaurant business until you know the rest of the restaurant business. And like you did, you took a job as a volunteer and said, okay, start me at the bottom, I'll learn what I got to learn. if you're going to make a career change into the restaurant business, one of the things that, because we get called in as consultants a lot, and what I often see is you don't want your first job in the restaurant business to be owner. Okay, that is not.
And you don't get to write a restaurant wine list until you've worked in a restaurant.
Or you've got to learn how to serve, and you've got to know how things work. But the thing about it is, you know, if you're the owner and your job is owner and your qualifications are owner, you're at the mercy of the dishwasher. And that's really a problem. You better know how to wash dishes yourself. Listen, we'll be back in just a moment talking with Tim Olson about winemaking and the wines that he makes in California. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25.
Hi, this is Tim Olson with Olson Ogden Wines here in the Russian River Valley of California. I'll be coming to New Jersey on April 30th to do a winemaker dinner where we'll be introducing our brand new Pinot Noirs along with our Syrahs from the Dry Creek Valley. We hope you can join us. Come on down and taste some great wines. Hope to see you then.
The Olson Ogden Wine Dinner will be held at Stage Left Restaurant on Monday, April 30th. For information, you can visit stageleft.com or go to restaurantguysradio.com or give us a call at 732-828-4444. We hope you can make it, meet a great winemaker, try his wines and our great food. That's the best way to enjoy wine after all. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. And we're talking with our old friend Tim Olson, who makes wines under the Olson Ogden label in California. He comes to our restaurant every once in a while and does a dinner, and they are truly wonderful things. I find that often restaurants put together wine dinners, I think, sloppily or haphazardly or haven't really thought out the food and wine together, and you don't get a 1+1=3 sort of synergy. But I think that the best way to appreciate wine, especially if you're not a professional, if you want to judge a wine, is not to go to a tasting and have a sip. I mean, you learn something from that. But to sit down and have wine with food over the course of time, to me, is the only real way to get to know a wine and judge a wine. Do you agree with that? How important is food, Tim?
I think food is paramount. You know, wine by itself is wine, food by itself is food, but when you put the two of them together, and especially the way you guys do it, because you're right, you take the time, you open up some wines, you kind of live with the wine for a while you guys create your menu, and I personally have found at the dinners I've been to at your place that the matching, the dance between the two is just superb.
You know, I think that it is, you know, the French have a saying, this is wine, they say wine is food. And, you know, when you evaluate a wine, you look at what it looks like, and you evaluate what it smells like, and then you evaluate what it tastes like. And many people may not realize that one of the most important things about high-end wine is what it tastes like, what goes on with the taste after you've swallowed it or spit it out, after it leaves your palate. And one of the things that's so important about that, that's called the finish, right? And you're still experiencing the finish when you put a bite of food in your mouth. And so you really do have wine and food together. You're experiencing them at the same time. So they have to work. And when they do, it's like an ingredient in a dish.
Yeah, I mean, if you're really, really thirsty, you don't guzzle a glass of wine. You drink a glass of water. The wine is more intricate. It's more part of the meal. It's part of the flavor profile of the meal.
Wine will actually pull the flavors out and make the food sing. Much like, you know, in music, if you've got the right singing, the right rhythm, the right lead, it all comes together. You don't hear all the different pieces. It's all harmony and it's all music.
We're going to go listen
to food and wine.
We're going to go listen to the news, but I want to talk more. I know that you have an interesting relationship between your wines and music, and we're going to talk about that after the Grateful Dead in particular. We're going to talk more with that about Tim Olson, winemaker from California, in just a moment. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon, Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Today's conversation is with an old friend, Tim Olson, makes wine in California. We've known each other for many years under many different labels that Tim has made wine. His current label is called Olson Ogden. He comes to our restaurant occasionally to do wine dinners. And if you want to find out when he's going to be out east next, you should go to stageleft.com or link there through restaurantguysradio.com. And you can one of these days come out and meet Tim yourself.
You know, Tim is coming out to the restaurant relatively soon to do a wine dinner with us at Stage Left. And, Tim, I have to tell you, I was going to surprise you. In my cellar, I had some great bottles. I had a bottle of 98 Tarius.
Which you made.
Three bottles of Tarius Pinot Noir from 99. And two magnums of the old O2 Olson Ogden, and I was going to, you know, pop them for the dinner and surprise you with those great old bottles, but my basement flooded and they're all gone now.
Oh, bummer.
Sorry.
All right, now.
So, surprise.
Now here's the deal. We would never sell those wines, but I have to tell you, they were in Mark's basement, which flooded, and I want your opinion on this. They were in Mark's basement, which flooded. The corks didn't come out. Now, I'm assuming the floodwaters in Cranford, New Jersey, were not the cleanest of waters. Would you? Now, Mark's gonna throw them out. He's like, I got a family to support. I can't take the chance. Those are pretty awesome wines. If they're still in okay condition and the water wasn't particularly hot or cold, would you risk it, you think?
Yeah, I don't think there's a lot of risk involved because unless you're talking about an awful lot of mold that has developed not just on the cork but had time to seep down through it, cork forms a pretty good seal, and so if the wine wasn't baked, you're going to lose the label, of course, but the wine itself should be fine.
Mark's offered to sell me the whole lot for $7.
I'll give you $8.
I'll tell you what, next time you're out here, we'll drink some of the wine, and you'll tell us how it did and if it suffered from its little submersion.
Yeah, next time you're out here, you and Francis will drink some of those wines.
I'd be happy to. You know, it's a funny thing about appreciating wine, because, again, you know, that's what drove me into becoming a winemaker was my love of wine and you know, just to touch on the food thing again, wine for me has always been associated with food. My ex-wife was a caterer and a phenomenal cook, and it was the food and the wine together that really drove the passion. And, you know, wine these days comes out so young. You know, we release our wines about 20 months after harvest, and while I want to make a wine that's age-worthy and can last 5, 10, 12, 15 years perhaps, at the same time they need to be somewhat approachable when they're young, because a lot of people just don't have the ability or the patience to wait them out.
Most of your wine is going to be drunk young.
I have an idea. Maybe we can make an arrangement sometime when you think you have a barrel that if it aged longer, maybe wouldn't be as accessible when it's young. Maybe we can have a special cuvée for us, and we'll accept a wine that is maybe not as approachable when it's young, but that will be age-worthy, and we won't sell it in the restaurant. We'll sell it to people to put in their cellars and wait.
That would be fun because, you know, I have to strike a balance when I make the wine, but if I knew that I could make a cuvée that would be laid down and really given the right time, that would be actually a lot of fun.
I think you listeners have just heard the beginning of one of this is how projects start.
That's exactly how they start.
It'll be the restaurant guy's cuvée of Tim Olson Pinot Noir. What do you think?
I love it.
Oh, I think that's great.
Love it. We'll make a little special juice for you guys.
So Tim, earlier in the show we were talking about the challenges of making great wine. But in your early years, you didn't just have to make great wine. You also had another profession that you had to do while you were making great wine. Talk to us a little bit about the challenges of that kind of dual life.
You know, my day job was and again is banking. I help people finance real estate. And in some ways, there's some parallels, because when you finance real estate, you have to be somewhat specific. And this was related to the couple I saw on the Food Network last night. Same thing. The guy was drawing the parallel between semiconductor development and cooking. There's a lot of precision. There's a lot of things. You know, it isn't just throw all the ingredients together, right? You don't just take your different things and throw them into a pot and turn the heat on. There's an order to which you do things. There are measurements. There are specific things and specific orders. Winemaking is the same thing. And therefore, you have to kind of think it through. I already know when I go to harvest the grapes that I want to bottle this wine unfined and unfiltered. I don't want to do a lot of processing, so we alter the way we approach making the wine, because you have to think it through. You have to start with the end in mind.
Let me just explain for the listeners what Tim just said. When you'll see this on wine labels a lot. They'll say unfined and unfiltered. It wasn't so long ago that if you had wine, it wasn't ever run through a filter. But with the emergence of, and so one of the ways that you would judge wine, even professionally, would be to look at the color of wine. And I remember in the old textbooks, they would say, you know, look for suspended particles and look for, you know, flaws in what a wine looks like. Well, that's almost unheard of now because, well, if you're making industrial wine, you just run it through a filter. So in a way, that makes cleaner wine. But in a way, it also allows industrial makers to be sloppier in the winemaking process because they can just fix it in the end with a filter. What Tim's doing is very selfish. He feels that you lose flavor by not running the wine through a filter, and so he has to be very careful in making a wine that's naturally clear and clean and bright. And did I get that about right?
Absolutely. It's kind of like the Dolby and stereo thing. Yeah, it might take out some of the things you don't want, but it's also going to take out some of the good stuff. And so you're spot on. If you know you can't filter, it's much like being an organic farmer. You have to think it through all the way because you can't just run out there and spray something if something starts to turn on you. You don't have that option. Same thing with me. I'm not going to filter that wine. I'm not going to find the wine. And therefore, I have to make sure that what we do all along the way is done with that in mind. So you have to be a little bit more careful. You have to be a little bit more thoughtful about it.
And just a quick note, filtering and fining are similar types of things in that they're taking things out of the wine to make it look more pristine.
We've talked about how winemaking is precise, and it is precise. And we likened it to semiconductors, but I think you can also liken it to like playing the violin because it's not just science. It's science and art, or at least artisanship. Play the Grateful Dead for your wines, don't you?
I do. if they start making requests, I'm going to start to worry. But I play a lot of music for my wine. Probably my two favorite bands, and they're probably on opposite ends of the spectrum, but it's the Grateful Dead and Pink Floyd.
Now, let's clarify. You're not just blasting the music while you work to pass the time for yourself. You actually think the wine is affected by the music.
Very much so.
How so?
When we talk to each other, when we listen to music, we don't communicate directly between people. We make sounds, and sound are really waves of air being moved through. And therefore, what you're talking about is vibrations. And on a vibrational level, it's energy. And so when you're playing positive music, good music, I think it soothes the soul and it soothes the spirits, and the spirits in this case being vino. I think it just makes for a more harmonious atmosphere. I happen to love music, and I generally have music on all day long, whatever I'm doing, unless I'm in a meeting with somebody. And like people, I think the wine is a living product. I treat wine like a living product, just like I treat food like a living product. It's not dead. It's not antiseptic. We don't sterile filter anything. So we try to create a really positive environment for the wine to grow up in.
I think what's interesting there is you talk about the science of wine, and I know for a fact that you endeavor to know everything that you can chemically about winemaking and what's going on with your wines, and you monitor very closely what's happening throughout the process. But by the same time, when you talk about playing the Grateful Dead for your wines, you're sort of saying, but there's also a whole bunch of stuff we don't know or can't know, and so you just have to go by feel. Is that true?
Yes, it's incredibly true. I'm reminded, Francis, of a movie I saw a couple of years ago, and in the movie there was a very interesting demonstration. There's a photographer in Japan named Masaru Emoto, and he did some experiments with water, in which he literally taped words onto bottles of water and then photographed them at a cellular level. And he would tape positive words like happiness and love, and he'd tape some negative words like hate and war, and then photographed the water at this molecular level, and the photographs came out like crystals. And the positive words looked like snowflakes or crystals, and the negative words had these very macabre kind of images. It was like very dramatic, and the only difference was the words he put on the bottles, which what he demonstrated was that just the intention, just the thought that you put behind something actually can affect things on a physical level.
And this was where? Who did this?
It was in a movie called What the Bleep Do We Know? Pretty interesting movie, a little bit, you know, esoteric. But the gentleman's name is Masaru Emoto, and he's a, and I thought it might have been just made up for the movie, but I actually went to the website and did a search through Google. It's a real thing. Huh. He's a real guy, and he actually proved this to be true. So just our thinking, just our intentions will actually have an effect on things.
Tim?
Yeah.
Sounds a little nutty to me.
I was just going to say, on the other hand, the counterpoint is, okay, I'm out here in California with the rest of the nuts and the flakes, right?
and we're in New Jersey. We may have toxic chemicals, but we got our hands on reason. But I'm going to go look that up. We'll put you we'll give you the link to all this on our site. And you can also check out the site for when you can meet Tim Olson when he comes out next. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on Central Jersey 1450. The time is 11:46.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Kathleen Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Kathleen showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission? To live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The matagat and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. You see, Kathleen Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or KatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Kathleen Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. And we're talking today with winemaker Tim Olson of Olson Ogden Wines in California. Tim, what appellation are Olson Ogden Wines, or what part of California are they from?
We are about an hour north of San Francisco and about 15 miles west of Santa Rosa, California, which is in the heart of Sonoma County. I live in a town called Sebastopol. That's where the winery is. We're maybe 12 to 15 miles from the Pacific Ocean as the crow flies.
Well, what many people may not realize just how important climate is, and many people do realize just how important climate is to grapevines. I mean, wines, because wine grapes are probably the most examined agricultural product in the world. I mean, nobody ever bottles banana juice and sells it 10 years later for, you know, $100 a bottle.
Maybe they sell it for – banana juice becomes worth less, not more, as you age it.
Exactly. So, grapevines are sort of like the canary in the coal mine, you know, because you can't move them. Number one, because they're stationary, and number two, it is the most examined agricultural product in the world. You're a winemaker. Is there climate change going on, and what effect is it having on winemaking from your perspective?
I don't think we notice it here on a day-to-day basis, per se, but I'm very aware of it because you're right. It is happening, and we are living in warmer and warmer climes. And, you know, I make a number of different kinds of wine. I've made just about every kind of wine out there. Pinot Noir happens to be my personal favorite, and Pinot in particular likes it cold. We have our challenges here in California because if you look at a map and you look at the latitude lines that run across the world, Burgundy, Dijon, and Beaune in France, where Pinot Noir has its home, is actually right about where Vancouver, B.C. is. Even Bordeaux, which grows in a warmer area, Cabernet and Merlot, is like Portland, Oregon. So we're well below that latitudinally. And so the climate change can affect us in a much deeper way here because it's going to get warmer here sooner, and Pinot Noir likes it cold. So
what happens to Pinot Noir if it warms up too much?
What happens is when the grapes are maturing, you've got a number of different things happening, right? The acids are dropping, the bricks or the sugar levels are starting to rise, the flavor profiles are coming up, and the tannins are starting to mature. And if you've ever had a wine where it was pretty rough and edgy or drying out or a little bitter, that's because the tannins weren't managed properly. And if you do the job right, what you get instead is good structure, good mouthfeel, but you still get a nice, balanced wine. And so getting the grapes to hang out on the vines, for example, most of the vineyards we work with are not harvested until October. So we get through the Indian summer of September, and I find that extra hang time really adds to the flavors and makes the wines, a little more complete.
I think our intuition is that, you know, it's grapes are a fruit, so the riper it gets, the better off you are.
Well, except and what,
you know, the
what,
more sugar that we can get into the grapes, the better off we
and,
are.
And Tim is saying that's not the case.
Right.
And if they get riper quicker and you harvest them sooner, while that may be a okay thing for peaches, that's not a great thing for wine grapes. They're just all sugary and less complex. Did I get that right?
You did. And, you know, 2004 actually is a very good case in point. You know, it was the most recent vintage in the market for us. We're just now releasing our 2005s. But in 2004, we had a heat wave come through in August and early September, and a lot of vineyards were harvested 2 to 3 weeks ahead of normal.
Mm-hmm.
I told my grower that I want him to just keep adding water to the vines and let the vines keep working, and as a consequence, we were the last ones in that block by about 10 days, and we harvested just 3 days sooner than we normally would start in this particular vineyard. And I think the results bear it out. We got a very nice 93-point score from the Wine Spectator for our 2004 Unti Vineyard Syrah. And we're going to be pouring at the dinner here on the 30th, the 2005, which I personally feel is an actually better wine. It was a better vintage, a lot of hang time, a lot of complexity in the wine. But to me, that's what really makes the difference, is giving the grapes enough time out there, letting the vines do their job so that, as I say, if the grower does a really good job, I get to be kind of lazy in the winery.
Well, you know, and I think what's interesting is that with climate change, there are really consequences for grape growing. You just said that Pinot Noir was your favorite grape, and you were making Syrah for a while only with Olson Ogden, and now you've started to make Pinot Noir. How did that come about?
You know, when we got started, you know, we both had day jobs, and we only did a couple hundred cases the first year, so we really only had room and budget for making about 4 tons, and it was going to be one or the other. I couldn't get my hands on the kind of Pinot Noir that I really wanted, and I don't want to make just okay wine. So we had access to the Unti Vineyard, which is just an incredibly great vineyard up in the Dry Creek Valley, and so we went with Syrah for the first couple of years, and then I got into Pinot Noir in 2005, and we actually bottled two different Pinots that we're going to be featuring at the dinner.
Well, I tell you, I love the 05 Pinots, and I know the Pinots that you made at Tarius were some of the best American Pinots I ever had in my life, and so you're a master with that. I'm afraid we need to leave it there, Tim, but we'll see you out here soon to do a dinner.
Looking forward to it, guys, and for all your listeners, please come on down and enjoy some great food and some good wine, and be looking forward to meeting
you
all.
You can find out more about the dinner, more about Tim Olson, and more about Tim Olson Wines at restaurantguysradio.com. We'll be back in just a moment. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi. We were talking with Tim Olson about his wines and a wine dinner that he has coming up. His current label is Olson Ogden, but he used to make wine under the Tarius label, 97 through maybe 99. And one of the vineyards, and people talk about winemakers are important, but vineyard sites are important too. One of the most extraordinary vineyard sites for Pinot Noir, and unique. I mean, I can spot it a mile away.
I think my favorite Pinot Noir vineyard in the whole United States.
If you put a glass of this in front of me totally blind, it's one of the few that I am sure that I can say, oh, yeah, that's from the Pisoni vineyard. A guy named Gary Pisoni and his son own a vineyard in the Santa Lucia Highlands in California, and there's a wind that blows through there all the time, like the Mistral in France. And it thickens the skins of the grapes and imparts between the soil and the exposure and the wind an extremely, well, a unique flavor profile.
Yeah, like it or dislike it, it is definitely unique.
Pisoni Vineyards Pinot Noir is one of the best ever. And I know that Tim Olson and Gary Pisoni are friends, so I'm hoping Tim just got back into making Pinot Noir, and hopefully next year he'll make a Pisoni Pinot Noir. And they're usually hard to come by when you find them, but they are phenomenal.
There are somewhere between, depending on the vintage, 8 and 12 different people who make Pisoni Vineyard
in
wines.
In small amounts.
They're, you know, Minor Family makes one. I think Sidori makes one. There are a bunch of different wine makers using Pisoni. Peter Michael uses, I believe, exclusively Pisoni Vineyard for their Pinot Noir.
I don't know if they still do.
There are some exceptional Pinot Noir out there using Pisoni Vineyard. Really, really and truly my favorite American Pinot Noir vineyard.
So I hope the dork talk hasn't bored you all, but at least we gave you some helpful tips. If you want to go out and try a great bottle of American Pinot Noir, or if you're at a restaurant, you see the word Pisoni, P-I-S-O-N-I, on the label anywhere, I would pick up that bottle.
Yeah, chances are it's a great bottle. There are very, very few bottles of Pisoni that I've had that I didn't think were great.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed Wine Geek Hour with the Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey 1450. The time is 12 noon.